2 Kings chapter 3. That in the timeline, that's going to come fall right in between, I think, 2 Chronicles 19 and 2 Chronicles 20. We're looking at the life of Jehoshaphat, and we talked about that some last week. Now, I tried to explain to you, and hopefully I got it correct, but I tried to explain to you some of the family connections between Jehoshaphat and Ahab. And so I decided I would try to put it in a picture here, which does you absolutely no good if you can't see it. Okay? Do you have it on the live stream too? All right. I'm airplaying to NBC. That's what I do all the time. Do I need to do anything different than that? All right. No, it's still nothing. All right. So, okay. Well, then you'll just have to imagine that I have the most fantastic slide you've ever seen, and it's up here right now, and it lays it out, okay? But you have Ahab in the north, and you have Jehoshaphat in the south. Here's where it gets confusing. Both of them had a son named Jehoram, okay? So you have Jehoram, the son of Ahab. You have Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, okay? That says turn on. I don't know what that means, but I'm just going to roll with it today. But both Ahab and Jehoshaphat have a son named Jehoram. Okay, so that complicates things. Now, Jehoshaphat's the king of the south. He's the king of Judah. He's the one that followed God. His son Jehoram married Athaliah, which was the daughter of Ahab. Okay, so Jehoshaphat helped Ahab because their families were connected by marriage. Okay, when Ahab died, he had a son who served less than 2 years, very short time. And that short period of time, that was Ahaziah. And then he was followed by the other Jehoram. Okay? So at one point in time, you had Jehoram ruling in the north and Jehoram ruling in the south, two separate families, but the same name. Okay? So welcome to Old Testament history and trying to keep all the names straight. But one reason that I think that Jehoshaphat was tempted to, and in fact did, help the north more than he should was because of that family connection. So, I mean, that never should have happened to start with, right? He never should have allowed the intermarriage between the families, but he did, and that, I think, influenced his later decisions, all right? So, we've already talked about 2 Chronicles 19, but now we're going to look at 2 Kings chapter 3, and I believe that this story here in 2 Kings chapter 3 happens in between chapters 19 and 20 of 2 Chronicles, okay? So 2 Kings chapter 3, Jehoram the son of Ahab began to reign over Israel in Samaria. Okay, so we've already skipped over Ahaziah. His time period was less than 2 years. All right, let's see here. Let's go back. Now that you got that, there you go. Okay, so you have Ahab and Jehoshaphat. Both of them have a son named Jehoram, but it was the daughter of Ahab that was married to Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat. And there are a bunch of other sons of Jehoshaphat that were listed. And when Jehoram ultimately became king, he killed all of his brothers to eliminate the competition. And the Bible says he was a lot more like Ahab. Wonder why he was a lot more like Ahab. Because he's married to Ahab's daughter, okay? Anyway, that's kind of the visual connection there, all right? So now we're looking at 2 Kings chapter 3. Verse 1 tells us Jehoram is king, all right? Verse number 4, Mesha, the king of Moab, was a sheep master and rendered unto the king of Israel 100,000 lambs, 100,000 rams with the wool, okay? I mean, sometimes we just kind of bump over those numbers. Have you ever tried to visualize that? I mean, some of you that you live in or drive through Lattimore, you know, there's a sheep farm there. And have you ever counted the sheep there? What do you think? 50? 75? I don't know. Maybe I'm shooting high. Okay, now, what would 100,000 sheep look like? Okay, but this was tribute. This was tribute money. It was, they were under the thumb of Israel. And so, this was their annual fees that they had to pay so that Israel would otherwise leave them alone, okay? So 100,000 lambs and 100,000 rams with the wool, Okay, so it wasn't just the animals. Then the with the wool means they had not been sheared yet for that year, which that would be another product that could be converted to a cash product. So you can understand why that sounds like a pretty expensive tax, doesn't it? I mean, even if he's raising it from the people, that's still fairly significant in their economy. Verse 5, came to pass when Ahab was dead, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. He saw an opportunity. All right, I couldn't defeat Ahab, but now I've got a chance in this transition. And really, if you look at the timeline, there's been two transitions. Ahab's son Ahaziah followed him, and now Jehoram is the second one. He's a brother of Ahaziah. So there's been a lot of turmoil in less than 2 years. There's been two transitions in power in 2 years. So he sees this as an opportunity. All right, this is my time to make a split. All right, so verse 6, King Jehoram went out of Samaria at the same time and numbered Israel. And he sent to Jehoshaphat, verse 7, king of Judah, saying, king of Moab has rebelled against me. Wilt thou go with me against Moab to battle? And he said, I will go up. I am as thou art, and my people as thy people, and my horses as thy horses. That sounds very similar to what he said to Ahab, right? He's already been met by the prophet after that battle, and the prophet says, why are you helping the ungodly? Why are you doing this? And yet, he did it again. The only explanation I can come up with is the family connection, or else Jehoshaphat had a hard time telling people no face to face. But he's like, yep, we're in. Verse 8, and he said, which way shall we go up? And he said, the way of the wilderness of Edom. So the king of Israel went, and the king of Judah, and the king of Edom. They fetched a compass 7 days' journey. So the alliance, if we're going to call it that, is three kings, Israel, Judah, and who's the third one they picked up? Edom. What was the connection with Edom and Moab? Okay, I mean, they're cousins too. I mean, Edom would have been the descendants of Esau. Moab would have been descendants of Lot. Okay, they're all family connections here. Verse 9, so the king of Israel went, the king of Judah, and the king of Edom, and they fetched a compass, which means they kind of went around in a circular pattern. They fetched a compass 7 days' journey, and there was no water for the host and for the cattle that followed them. Now, why were their cattle following them? Were these just curious animals that wanted to see where they were going? Okay, what kind of refrigeration was available in this day in Bible history? Not much. I mean, if they were going to preserve things, they pretty much had to preserve it with salt or, something like that. So the cattle that followed them, that was the supply wagon. I mean, the good news is they had fresh meat, but they had to, bring the cattle. This term would include cows or possibly sheep or whatever, but they were bringing the provisions along with them. So you got the people, you got the horses that would be used in battle, and then you have the food animals. All of these need water. Verse 10, the king of Israel said, alas, the Lord hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab. Now, who said this? No, the king of Israel, Jehoram. Okay, Jehoram, king of Israel, said this. Jehoram, king of Israel, is a worshiper of whom? He's the son of Ahab and Jezebel. And he has followed the idols. Now, why all of a sudden is he using the name of the God of heaven? You see how he shifted gears here? Oh, the Lord has delivered us into. So why didn't he say Baal has delivered us into? Right? Why is he going to blame this on Judah's God, so to speak, not the God that he worships? I just find that interesting. But he says the Lord has called these three kings together to deliver them in the hand of Moab. Verse 11, Jehoshaphat said, is there not a prophet of the Lord that we may inquire of the Lord by him? Does that sound familiar? Said almost the exact same thing when he was helping Ahab. That's when we met the prophet Micaiah. Remember that story? And they tried to get him just say what they want to hear. And finally, Micaiah says, all right, this is what I really saw. And Ahab says, see, I told you he wouldn't say anything good. It's almost a replay of the same story. This is like a version 2 of the same incident almost. And verse 11, is there not a prophet of the Lord that we may inquire of the Lord by him? And one of the king of Israel's servants answered and said, here is Elisha, the son of Shaphat, which poured water on the hands of Elijah. Okay, we've skipped over that a little bit in the first couple of chapters. We're going to go back and catch that when we go to Ahaziah and Jehoram. But verse 12, Jehoshaphat said, the word of the Lord is with him. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. And Elisha said unto the king of Israel, What have I to do with thee? All right, how would we say that in our terminology today? What do you want? Why are you here? I don't want to talk to you. Now, for some of you, that's kind of normal no matter who you're talking to when you first get up. Okay, but this wasn't one of those scenarios. So does this sound like a polite thing for the man of God to say? Who are you? Why are you here? I don't talk to you. But there's a reason here. What's the rest of the explanation? Get thee to the prophets of thy father and to the prophets of thy mother. So in essence, what is he saying? Why are you going to call on God when you're in trouble? Why don't you call on the prophets of Baal, the prophets of your father and mother? Why don't you call on the prophets of Baal? You offer sacrifices to them. You give them money. You feed them. You're in trouble. Get the prophets of Baal. He's trying to make a point here, right? King of Israel said unto him, Nay, for the Lord hath called these three kings together to deliver them in the hand of Moab. Again, he's blaming God, not Baal. Okay? Verse 14, Elisha said, As the Lord of hosts liveth, before whom I stand, surely were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee nor see thee. That's a pretty strong statement. But if you think about it, does that line up with some of the admonitions of have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them? Sure it does. Sounds a lot like New Testament principles of association or separation or how we're to respond. So Elisha's not being rude just because he thinks he can get away with it. He is, in essence, trying to rebuke the ungodliness and the idolatry of Jehoram, king of Israel. He said, I don't want anything to do with you. You don't really want anything to do with God. Why am I having this conversation with you? He said, except for the presence of Jehoshaphat, who he knew was a worshiper of God. And Jehoshaphat obviously has a weakness here, okay? But in general, Jehoshaphat has restored the worship of God. He's torn down idols he could find. We talked about it last week, how he went through and redistributed priests and Levites to all the cities and restarted the teaching of God's word in all of the countryside of Judah. He really did want to serve God and do what's right. So he said, All right, because of Jehoshaphat, I'll try to give you an answer. And Elisha performs a miracle, which we'll talk about here in just a second. But I want you to see this. Verse 15, bring me now a minstrel. And it came to pass when the minstrel played that the hand of the Lord came upon him. Okay? So at this point, Elisha did not have a message from God ready to go. Okay? Because God would speak to him and he would take what he was told and deliver it. God had not given him a message ahead of time. There were times when he did get a message ahead of time, right? We go on a couple more chapters here, chapter 5, and you have the story of Elisha and Naaman where he told him to dip in the river 7 times and be clean. Well, Elisha's servant went and took money from him after Elisha refused to. When he got back, Elisha already knew it. Sometimes God revealed it to him ahead of time. In this case, God had not. So he said, bring me a minstrel. That was simply a term used for a young lady, typically, but it was a musician. Now, what songs did she sing? Was it vocal music? What does it specifically say here? When the minstrel what? Played. So this sounds like it was, instrumental music. Very, very similar to 1 Samuel 16 when the evil spirit from the Lord was on Saul and they said, let's find you someone to play. Okay? What you see here is the influence of music. And I'm pointing this out. This was instrumental music. This was not music with words. Why is that significant? Because many, many times today, people that want to argue for a change of style, a lot of times, one of the main points of the argument is the words are good. The text is good. It's got a solid message. And, there is an argument. The argument, it's not valid, but the argument is basically as long as the words are good, the style of music doesn't matter. I submit to you that Christians who want to justify certain actions are pretty much the only people that try to make that argument. If you go to the rock music crowd, all of them will tell you, my music has a message and I style the rhythms, I style the harmonies, I style the beat to achieve a certain effect. They'll all tell you that. They're not trying to hide it. Okay? godly musicians would say the same thing in a different way. I structure the rhythms and the harmonies and the melodies to accomplish a certain effect. Okay? The people that try to say, well, the music doesn't matter, it's just the words, they're the ones that want to do something different and are trying to find a justification for it. Okay? That is the bottom line. And here, what you see here is the minstrel played, probably string music. Okay? But what you see here is that music does have an effect on people. Okay? One of the best ways for you to visualize this is to take a small toddler, 2-3 years old. All right? See if you can find some John Philip Sousa patriotic music. It's got a good march tempo to it, right? Just hit play and you'll turn it up and then watch what that toddler does. You know, they start moving. Sometimes you see, YouTube videos or, you know, things on social media or something like that, but some commercial will come on TV or some song will come on, and that people think it's cute because some little kid, you know, just wearing a diaper, maybe a t-shirt and a diaper, and the song comes on and they start trying to gyrate, and they think it's funny because they can't really dance or they can't keep rhythm, but they're trying. Why do those children respond that way to that music? I mean, I like the way Tim Fisher worded it. I'm going to borrow his wording, but the principle is timeless, and that is this. They are doing what the music asks them to do, okay? Instrumental music, apart from any words, has an effect on our bodies. There are certain rhythms that almost ask you to respond in a certain way, okay? Some of you were at the American Legion baseball games, okay? They play certain songs, okay? And some of you did the chicken song. Saw you. Okay? That music has a certain association, and you either did it or you're kind of sitting on your hands to fight it, right? Okay? And I mean, that's a silly example, but the point that I'm trying to make is that instrumental music, apart from any other words, does have an effect. It was a poet in 1700s says, "Music hath charms to soothe the savage beast." Okay? That's the principle behind, you know, animal charmers and stuff like that. But my point is this. The minstrel played instrumental music that was of a godly and a soothing character, and it put Elijah in a frame of mind to where he could receive the message from God. There's another principle there, isn't it? We need to set aside distractions or try to get our mind focused so that we can hear and understand, receive what God wants us to hear, right? But this music put Elisha in a right frame of mind. Why? You think Elisha was a little bit worked up here? I'm going with yes. I mean, we already know he did not give a very polite, calm response to the king of Israel, Jehoram. What are you doing here? Why are you coming to me? Why don't you go to the prophets of Baal? And I don't think Elisha was the kind of guy that would just say that in a very calm, monotone fashion. He was more of a passionate, fiery kind of guy, right? So he's all worked up, and I guess I've got to try to get a message now, but look what you've done, all right? I need some help. Bring me a musician, okay? But when godly and soothing music was played, it put him in a frame of mind. If you believe that music is neutral, then take music that we would use in our church, Victory in Jesus, Amazing Grace, whatever. All right, this is a hypothetical. I'm not actually asking you to do it. But let's just suppose that you take that music. Josiah plays the piano, all right? So we'll use Josiah as an example. We'll find a karaoke bar on Friday night somewhere here in Shelby or Gastonia, or maybe we'll go to Charlotte so we're further away and nobody knows what we're doing, okay? But we're going to go in there, and when it's his turn, you know, when it's his turn, he's going to play, you know, Victory in Jesus or Amazing Grace or Are You Washed in the Blood, just like we would do it here. If the music itself is neutral, it doesn't matter, right? That should be accepted there. What are they going to do? You're going to boo him out and throw him out, right? Because that style of music doesn't fit with the atmosphere that they want there. It doesn't. They're trying to set a certain atmosphere and a certain mood, and the kind of music that we would play out of the hymnal would not fit with that atmosphere. Well, the same thing's true with the world's music. I mean, they're trying to set a certain mood and a certain atmosphere, move certain attitudes and get certain responses, and that kind of music does not fit with God's word or the worship of God either. They don't mix, okay? But here, the minstrel plays, and when the kind of music that was consistent with godliness was played, it allowed him to get himself in the right frame of mind, and then God spoke to him. The end of verse 15 says, "The hand of the Lord came upon him." Verse 16, here's the miracle. And he said, "Thus saith the Lord, make this valley full of ditches. For thus saith the Lord, ye shall not see wind, neither shall ye see rain, yet that valley shall be filled with water that ye may drink, both ye and your cattle and your beasts." Now, that's interesting. What does this message from God require on the part of the kings? Work and faith, right? Is that not what God tells us? Trust and obey is the way our hymn is. Okay, God gave them an assignment. If they did not fulfill the assignment, they would not have seen the next blessing. He said, go make this area full of ditches. What he's saying is dig pits to hold the water. Dig ditches for the water to flow through. So they had an assignment. What if Jehoshaphat and Jehoram were like, that's crazy. There's not going to be wind, there's not going to be any rain, but you want me to dig a ditch? I don't think so. I'm already parched. I'm already struggling out here in this desert heat. What if they'd had that response? Would they have seen the blessing? No. But he says, thus saith the Lord. What were they to do? They were to take God at his word and go do it. And ultimately, that's what they did. But God required obedience. He required some effort on their part in this case, which is very different from what we're going to see in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. There are times when God says, all right, I want you to do this in preparation. There are other times, which we'll see in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, where God says, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Okay? But here, God gave them an assignment to do. He said, go dig the ditches and get ready. And then notice verse 18. Now, does that sound like a small thing? I mean, how many people do we have out there? We don't have an exact number. But if we have the armies of three kings, it's safe to say that we have thousands and thousands of people. I mean, if you're going to feed thousands and thousands of people and you don't know how long this campaign is going to be, how many animals do you think are brought along for food? Hundreds, if not thousands? Okay, so how much water is it going to take? Any of you had to water larger animals, like horse or cow or something like that? Okay, how much water does it take for just a few? Okay, and we're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of larger cattle, sheep, goats, oxen, whatever, the horses that would be used in battle and pull the wagons and whatever, and then the thousands of people. How much water are we talking about? A whole lot. I mean, a lot more than a swimming pool is worth. Okay? So, we're talking about a lot of water, but how is that referenced here then in verse number 18? This is but a light thing in the sight of the Lord. I mean, to me, that sounds like a big deal, right? If God is going to produce thousands and thousands of gallons of fresh drinkable water in the middle of a desert, that sounds like a pretty big deal, right? And Elisha says, that's a small thing for God. God's going to do something bigger than that. I like that. Because the things that seem impossible to us are, don't even bother God. Right? That's not a stumbling block. That's not a problem. I mean, I can look at things and go, we're going to die. Now, in this case, it was we're going to die because there was no water. But are there other things that we look at and go, I'm going to die? These students, they've never looked at their homework and said, I'm going to die. Right? You've never done that. Okay? You've never looked at your household bills and go, this is it. It's over. You know, you've never looked at a situation and gone, all right, I'm done. There's no answer to this. I mean, humanly speaking, there are many times when we get to the end of ourselves. But what was the end of ourselves? God had an answer for that. And then the prophet said, oh, that's a little thing. God can handle that simply. God's going to do something bigger than that. You know, there's times when we just need our perspective reset, don't we? That what's big to us is small to an almighty creator. It's small to the God of heaven, which is why he says, God's going to do, this is but a light thing in the sight of the Lord, for he will deliver the Moabites also into your hand. Verse 19, ye shall smite every fenced city and every choice city and fell every good tree and stop all wells of water and mar every good piece of land with stones. So it sounds like a complete domination and utter victory is prophesied by God. Which obviously, if they're going three kings against one, they feel like Moab is a formidable enemy and such, and they're fighting on Moab's territory. This is a big deal. And yet, the miracle of the water was a small thing, a light thing, no big deal. It was like throwing a couple of feathers in your backpack. Didn't even really feel it. as far as the weight that God would feel to do something like that. So Elisha does a miracle, and then he gives a prophecy of complete victory. Verse 20, "And it came to pass in the morning, when the meat offering was offered, that behold, there came water by the way of Edom, and the country was filled with water." Where'd that come from? Yes. God brought it. He said, "Dig ditches," and they dug ditches. I mean, think irrigation trenches or, you know, transport canals kind of thing. They dug ditches, and God brought them water from somewhere. I mean, there's no physical explanation for this. Somebody would already come up with this idea. Well, if we can trench from Lake so-and-so over here, we can bring some water down to us. Obviously, there was no natural explanation for it, but God brought it, and the country was filled with water. And then God used that in their victory. Verse 21, "When all the Moabites heard the kings were come up to fight against them, they gathered all that were able to put on armor and upward and stood in the border. And they rose up early in the morning, and the sun shone on the water, and the Moabites saw the water on the other side as red as blood." Was it blood? No, God caused them to see it that way. Okay, this is God intervening. So, what was their conclusion? Verse 23, they said, "This is blood. The king surely are slain, and they've smitten one another. Now, therefore, Moab to the spoil." So, they show up to a battle with a party mentality, right? That's what happens. Oh, look at that. Now, they just assumed those three kings couldn't get along. Something set them against each other, and you know, they fought it out amongst themselves. Well, all we have to do is go pick up the spoils. Showing up to the battle with a lighthearted party-type mentality is going to get you licked. It is. Now, how is the Christian life very often described? You know, as a war. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, powers, rules of darkness, this world. Wherefore, taking you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand in the evil day, and having done all to stand. Very often, our Christian life is described as conflict. Okay? But see, they showed up to a battle with the mentality of, you know, Christmas. Hey, free gifts for everybody. Let's just go take their spoil. And they got destroyed. Verse 24, "When they came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites rose up and smote the Moabites, so they fled before them. But they went forward, smiting the Moabites, even into their country. And they beat down the cities on every good piece of land, cast every man his stone, and filled it. And they stopped all the wells of water and felled all the good trees." Now, I read that in just a few seconds. How long do you think that took? You know, that's like saying, "We remodeled this building and moved over here." I can say that in a sentence or two, but that was a process of 2 years worth of work, right? And a lot of money. And what this scenario here is the same way. They cast every man his stone on a good piece of land. Any of you tilled up a garden patch? Yeah? One of the most aggravating things to deal with is stones. I mean, we've tilled up a section of our yard for a garden patch, and I mean, you can till the same spot 3 or 4 years in a row. It's like, where do these rocks keep coming from? I mean, I didn't realize these were seeds that would multiply, you know? Where do they keep coming from? But especially in a larger field where it was food crops, the stones would hinder the plow and the moving forward stuff. So by casting stones into the good ground, they're setting them back. They're reducing their effectiveness. They're causing them a lot of extra work. They cut down every good tree. All right, well, then their lumber supply is going to be short for building things. Their firewood supply temporarily increases, but that's not what they needed. I mean, they needed production. And then it says they stopped the wells. All right, we might think, all right, you turn off the valve, but that's not what that means. They stopped it up. What does that mean, to stop the wells? They're shoveling dirt in there. I mean, you ever look down a well, even a small one? How much dirt would you have to actually shovel in there to where you've kind of muddied it up and capped it off to where you can't get anything out of there? That's a lot of shovels worth, okay? So there's a lot of work that's involved in just these few statements here. But Elisha promised God is going to give you a complete dominating victory. Here's what you want to do with them, and they followed through on it. They destroyed their economy, both the crops, the ability to build things with the trees. Their livelihood was threatened. I mean, they could have eventually redug out the wells. They could, you know, bring out buckets of muddy water, and then they'd have to filter it and sift it and all that. But they set them back a long time. They're not going to rebel while they're in that condition. And they're certainly in no condition to fight for a while after that. So in essence, they're going to have peace. Okay, verse 25 again, the middle of the verse. They felled all the good trees. Only in Kirhaseth they left the stones thereof. Howbeit the slingers went about it and smote it. Wonder what that looked like. I mean, I envision it as kind of like a drive-by shooting where, you know, they didn't knock it down, but you got all these holes in the wall. The slingers went around. That's my best guess. The slingers went around and smote it, okay? They went around with their slings and stones and knocked holes in it, or, you know, broke out the windows or whatever they did to it. Verse 26, when the king of Moab saw the battle was too sore for him, he took with him 700 men that drew swords to break through even unto the king of Edom, but they could not. He realizes he's going to lose the big battle. He's just trying to get a hostage, get a small victory out of this, something that he can salvage out of this. And this 700 men was probably his, what we would call special forces, his elite guard, just like David had the king's bodyguards and so forth. Verse 27, when he could not, what did he do? Then he took his eldest son that should have reigned in his stead and offered him for a burnt offering on the wall. And there was great indignation against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land. Why in the world would he do that? That was considered the most expensive sacrifice he could have possibly made. What happened in 1 Kings chapter 18 when you have Elijah and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel? They started doing their little rituals, and then when they got no answer from Baal, what did they try to do? It got more intense to try to get Baal's attention. They began to cut themselves with knives. Well, maybe if we offer our own blood, he'll see that we're serious and Baal will answer us. Well, who would normally follow the king? Who would be the successor? Usually the king's eldest son, right? So he took his eldest son, who would have been a prized possession in the household of a king, even more special than children already are, and he took him and offered him as a sacrifice. Now, that's just mind-blowing. I hope you don't skip over that. So what did he do? He went up on the city, I think it says he offered him on the wall. Yeah, so he went up on the city wall. And those walls were often wide enough that you could walk without trouble. And in some cases, I've read about cities where they had chariot races on top of the walls. They were a lot wider than what we would think of today. Okay, but he built an altar up there. So in the sight of the armies, in the sight of all of his people, he went to the high spot and he offered his son as a human sacrifice. Can you imagine watching that? I mean, some of you are really, really upset when some of the folks around here talk about going out and disguising themselves in the wood to try to get one of Bambi's relatives. Okay? Some of you are like, yeah, that's good, or I don't want to go get it, but I like the venison. And some of you are all bent out of shape at the cruelty of that. You know, you don't like spiders, but you don't want to squish it. I mean, this is not an animal. This is not a pest. It's not an insect. This is a human being. He literally took a human being, put him on the altar, killed him. I don't know if he killed him before or after, doesn't matter, but he killed him and he offered him there as a sacrifice. That would have been a horrific thing to watch, a horrific thing to smell, a horrific thing to contemplate that evening when you go back and lay down. What in the world? I mean, it should have made them think, this is what our God demands of us? What kind of God are we worshiping anyway? But he did that, and it still did not, you know, overcome the God of Israel. It says there was great indignation against Israel. So Moabites are going to say, well, Israel caused this mess, right? They're blaming Israel. You thought that was a modern problem, didn't you? Okay, that's been around for centuries, okay? But they blamed Israel for all of this. And then once they finished all the other things that they were going to do, it says they departed from him and returned to their own land. This happened. This was a miracle of God. This miracle of God happened because of Jehoshaphat and his desire to serve God. Okay? We've seen it in, I believe it's in 2 Chronicles 16, where it says, the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on the behalf of them whose heart is perfect towards him. God desires to step in and show his power, to show his person, to demonstrate who he is. Here, because of Jehoshaphat's service to the Lord and his desire to do right, God decided he was going to step in and do something fantastic for Jehoshaphat. Now, there's still the matter of why was he cooperating with the king of Israel, you know, and that'll still be addressed. But what you see here is a situation that from a human standpoint was 100% impossible. And then the prophet said, it's a light thing. That's not even a big deal for God. God's going to take care of all of this. Now, we have one more major story here in the life of Jehoshaphat, which we won't get started today because we won't have enough time to finish. But what is the take home today for you and me from the life of Jehoshaphat and from this incident? Number one, make good decisions early. Because Jehoshaphat had made a decision previously to allow his child to marry with the household of Ahab, and it influenced later decisions. Right? What else do we see here in the life of Jehoshaphat? Simply this, what is impossible with men is a light thing for God. When God wants to do something, he can intervene. We're going to see that in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. That's the next story in the life of Jehoshaphat. You can read that ahead for next week. Okay, but what we're going to see there is Jehoshaphat says, God, you're able to do this. This is not a big deal for you. This is beyond us. And basically, if you don't help me, I'm not going to have any help. I mean, that's the example that we learn is to say, hey, instead of stressing myself out about this when it's beyond myself anyway, let me go to the Lord and say, Lord, this is too hard for me, but it's not too hard for you. And remember, the same God that helped Jehoshaphat is the same God to whom we pray today, right? God's still alive, it's the same God, and he can still work in the same ways whenever he chooses to. There's a lot of valuable take-home for you and me from the life of Jehoshaphat. We'll look at 2 Chronicles chapter 20, Lord willing, next week, and then try to wrap up the study of the life of Jehoshaphat. But let's close with a word of prayer this morning, can we?